Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode, I was joined by Daniel Copley, a consumer expert at Zoopla, and Shripali Chauhan Tufail, a divorce specialist with Amicable. Dan is an editor with over 10 years of experience in the property, lifestyle and fashion sectors, having worked for brands such as M&S and Uber and contributed to publications like The Telegraph and GQ. Dan champions readers' interests in various subject areas. Shripali helps couples navigate both the emotional and legal aspects of ending a relationship. She's a former solicitor with over 20 years of experience in dispute resolution, family and commercial law. We begin this episode by exploring the different ways you can own property and how it can be divided if a relationship ends. We look at Zoopla's research around divorce and property and discover that couples are forced to live together for an average of 1.3 years after they split up, as well as some of the financial constraints and children issues around property and separation. Dan talks about how mortgages work when a couple separates, and Shripali explores the different options available to separating couples, as well as creative ways you can navigate living together if you can't afford to rehouse immediately. We finish by talking about how to protect yourself financially when you divorce or separate and own property. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's lovely to see you. I'm really looking forward to this. We know, don't we, that houses are usually our greatest asset. And in a divorce scenario, sorting out the house and sorting out where people are going to live is normally people's biggest priority. So we've got the most pressing concern and the most valuable asset all rolled into one episode. So it's going to be an important one. And it's usually one that people get sort of most hung up on, in terms of trying to work out what the most fair thing to do is and how to make sure that kids don't suffer and that kind of stuff. So I'm really looking forward to having a chat with you both today. And I know, Daniel, that Zoopla have done some amazing research in this area as well. So we will come on to that. And I'm looking forward to understanding a bit more about what you found out. But why don't we start with just some of the basics in terms of property. And Daniel, maybe you can explain, what are the different options? How can people own property together?
Well, there are two main ways that couples can own a property together, and that's as joint tenants or tenants in common. If you're joint tenants, you jointly own the whole property, you split the property and any proceeds you earn from it 50-50 when you come to sell. If one of you wishes to remain in the property, they'll need to buy out the other one's 50% share. And joint tenancy is great if you're both putting in the same amount of deposit, splitting the mortgage and the bills equally. But if one of you feels they've contributed more than the other, it can lead to difficulties and disputes in court if you separate. The other way that I mentioned is tenants in common. And this is more typical for a cohabiting couple or friends, could be a married couple also. And this is where you can enlist a solicitor's help to agree how much of the property each party owns. So, for example, if one of you is putting in a lot more money for the deposit and mortgage costs, you may decide to split the portions 25-25 or any other type of split. The agreement can be changed at a later date if one of you starts contributing at a higher level. And if you do go down the tenants in common route, it's probably a good idea to have a cohabitation agreement or a declaration of trust drawn up. But usually, if you're married or in a civil partnership, the rules are theoretically quite straightforward when you break up in terms of how your assets will be divided, but of course rarely a simple process in practice.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe that's where Shripali, you can come in and just add to that. So it sounds like from what Daniel's saying, there's two different ways of owning a property.
one where you can specify the share that you own and another where it's assumed it's a 50-50. So let's say that a couple in those in each of those scenarios are divorcing. Is it as straightforward as Daniel has laid out when it comes to separating property on divorce?
Yeah, unfortunately not. So on divorce, there's no defined formula and each case will depend on sort of individual circumstances. And I think the biggest consideration is the welfare of the children and making sure that they're adequately housed and that their needs are adequately met. So in terms of a wider approach, there's sort of a 50-50 starting point, and then a reason to depart from that 50-50 starting point is because one of your needs outweighs the other. So in most circumstances, it doesn't matter how the property is held, or in fact, whether the property is held in one person's name as against the others.
Okay, yeah, because we get that a lot, don't we? So I often have people ring up and say, oh, we haven't got anything to sort out because the property is all in my name. And that's not necessarily when it comes to divorce, particularly in a long marriage, the case, is it? Even if the property is owned by one person, the other person may have a claim or a right to that part of that property just the same. That's right, isn't it, Shripali?
Yeah, absolutely. And the length of marriage has a lot to do with that. So there are circumstances where if it's a very short marriage and there are no children involved, then there may be an argument to sort of say that, well, because these assets were pre-acquired, there's less reason to approach it from that 50-50 sort of general point of view. Whereas if it is a long marriage and there are children involved, then essentially everything gets put into the pot and then you start looking at it from a needs point of view.
So although, as Daniel says, in theory, you can specify the percentage of the property that you own, in practice, when you get divorced, that might not be the case.
That's absolutely correct. And where there are young children involved, as long as their needs are adequately met, that's certainly a reason to pull away and depart from the whole contributions argument.
Right. So Daniel, then its contributions are important and setting that out when times are good, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's how things will end up from what Shripali is saying in the event that you divorce. I think Zoopla's done some research about couples living together after they separate as well, haven't they? Tell us a little bit about that. What happens then? So we've got to a situation where we've decided to separate and we're going to divorce and we're going through this process now of understanding who's going to own what and how it's all going to be divided. What did you find out about that interim period before everyone's able to go their separate ways? What did your research show about people living together at that point?
What I might just do, Kate, if it's all right, is just take the question one level up and just reflect that people move home and the whole property market moves for a real diverse and varied array of reasons. We often think about this as something like an aspiration and need scale, with aspiration at one end and need at the other. And, you know, up at one end of the aspiration scale, you might have things like, I'm moving because I want a larger garden or to be around more green spaces. And at the other end, the need scale, you might be moving because you can no longer afford your mortgage payments, or perhaps you've split up or got divorced and the family home is no longer appropriate for you. And clearly what we're talking about today is more at the need end of the scale, but it's really important to reflect that the market moves for a variety of reasons and each of those movers will have different circumstances and different needs and different requirements. But yeah, thinking about buying a property together and then splitting up or divorcing, that is where we focus this research, as you quite rightly say. And what we found is that A, it's more common than people might think to buy a property together and then split up. So from our group that we polled, 34% who had purchased a home then split up with their partner. And this can clearly have long-lasting consequences if you do divorce when you own a property together. And what we found is that the amount of time you have to stay together in that home is kind of one of the main causes of tension. So couples that did split up after buying a house together were forced to live together for over a year on average. I think it's 1 year, 3 months, it averaged out. And the reasons behind that, the first one is all around finance and affordability, which might not come as a surprise. So those, about half of those that remained living together after splitting up said that they were doing so because they simply couldn't afford to move out. And actually this weighted more towards women than it did men. So we found that 46% of women polled couldn't afford to move out because they had no savings. They had no additional funds to fall back on. And that figure dropped to 37% for men. There are other reasons that couples are staying in the same place after splitting up other than finance. One is children. So 17% said they remained living together in the same place for the sake of children. And 13% said they're involved in some form of standoff with their ex, with neither party prepared to move out or unable to reach a decision that would allow them to move out. But dipping back into the finance quickly, and with cost of living at the front of everybody's mind at the moment, 42% of married respondents said it took them longer to get out of their joint mortgage than it did for them to get a divorce. And that averaged out at about 1 year trying to get out of that joint mortgage. And of those people that did separate and then managed to move out, 2/3 said that they were continuing to pay their share of the mortgage and then additional accommodation costs on top, which is just such a tough position to be in today with mortgage rates and with rents. And then on top of that, another third, roughly a third, 29%, revealed that they had to pay a fee for ending their mortgage early, which is pretty common. So an early repayment charge if you're on a fixed term mortgage. And that averaged out to another 2.6K average payment. So it all boils down to, even after you've made the decision to split or to divorce, getting out of that home is rarely a simple thing. Aside from the divorce, because of finance, because of affordability, because of consents of your partner, because of fixed term mortgages. So it's many reasons why people don't immediately make that clean split in terms of property.
It sounds really tough for people. I mean, we know a cost of living crisis, we know increasing mortgage rates, and we know rents, as you say, that seem to be fairly uncontrolled in lots of parts of the country now, are all contributing to making it very difficult for people to move on. Shripali, what impact does it have on couples when, as Daniel has described, they are effectively forced to stay in the same property whilst dealing with their emotions around divorcing or separating?
It's incredibly difficult, and it makes trying to resolve matters even more emotional. So there are various things that people are now sort of trying to do to try and make that a little bit easier. Bird nesting has become something that's becoming more common and popular recently, whereby the children stay in the family home and the parents take it in turns to stay in the home but move away, either with extended family if they've got that support and resource, or move into a rental accommodation, which they then share with the other partner whilst they're able to resolve their financial arrangement. So it's very much an interim solution, but it's one where a little bit more stability is provided for children, especially younger children, whilst they transition and whilst they help the children transition into a completely new and different sort of family routine. But yeah, that's something that's growing in popularity. And then the other alternative, if resources allow, is for one of the partners just to simply move out and rent whilst they try to agree and resolve their financial situations.
And that's tough, isn't it? I mean, I always get asked in those circumstances, I get a lot of telephone inquiries where people say to me, oh, I've been told not to move out, that somehow that's going to damage my case. Just talk a little bit about that, Shripali, from a legal perspective, because it is something that that solicitors say to people, isn't it?
It is, and it makes no difference, because ultimately the status quo remains until and unless a financial arrangement is agreed. In terms of divorcing, that doesn't end your financial claims, which is why we encourage everybody that calls amicable to resolve their financial claims and get that dealt with in a way that provides sort of certainty and clarity. But sometimes there's no choice but for one partner to move out on an initial temporary basis whilst they're able to agree matters with more permanency.
Yeah. I guess people get nervous about whether or not they're going to be accused of abandoning the home and that kind of stuff. And I think in those cases, you can always document what you've done, can't you? And put set it all out in a letter or an email to say, look, I'm not abandoning, but I think for the sake of everybody psychologically, it's better if we have a little bit of distance and space. Because when the emotions are raw, it can be really difficult, particularly as you say, if there are children in the house, to be experiencing and witnessing that atmosphere, even as parents, when you're trying your hardest not to, you know, show how you're feeling or argue in front of the children. Kids pick up on atmosphere and it can feel uncomfortable. And it's just, I think sometimes if you can, as you say, resource dependently, if you can move out, sometimes that just creates a little bit of extra space, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And it's so important, especially where there are young children involved. And like you say, they may not fully understand what's going on, but they can absolutely sense the fact that there is a relationship breakdown and the parents are modelling how to behave. So it's really important that where you're able to put a little bit of space between you so that you can try to reflect and deal with the process in a slightly kinder way.
And Daniel said as well that the length of time, and just remind us, Daniel, you said it was about 15 months, a year and 3 months, wasn't it, the average time it took people to get out of a mortgage? And we know that you can divorce even with the new government kind of no fault rules, which do mean the divorce takes a little bit longer. We know that we can get most divorces through if they're amicable in around 9 to 12 months. So that's considerably less time than it's taking people to actually resolve the financial mortgage situation, isn't it? But let's just say for the sake of argument, you don't have the resources. Most people don't have the resources to set up a whole new home. Daniel, you mentioned, didn't you, that some people were left paying their share of the mortgage and then rental costs. For most people, that's just not tenable. Most of us don't have a spare grand lying around to a month to go and rent a flat somewhere. So Shapali, what can you advise, or how can we help people if they're in the situation where they've got to stay put?
Just to really try to, where there are children involved, to try to agree as much as possible the arrangements regarding the children so that there are clear boundaries with a view to maintaining flexibility and kind of understanding that they're changes, their needs change, but also just sort of understanding that everybody needs a bit of space in order to reflect and understand, because there is a process that you need to go through in order to reach those agreements, especially when you use a service whereby you're having to go through financial disclosures and you're not able to reach those agreements immediately. You're making inquiries, you're investigating your mortgage capabilities, your earning capacities. So to try to just help people understand that you need to give each other time and space and respect the fact that you might both be at different points of your emotional journey and that you might need to give your partner some time to catch up, as it were, or for you to do the catching up.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with couples before where we've talked about literally zoning the house, where, you know, we've talked about times where you can use the kitchen, which sort of reception rooms are yours versus theirs. We know we've had kind of different bedroom arrangements. They've had to move kids into one bedroom so they can create two bedrooms for themselves. And so there are all sorts of, you know, ways that you can navigate it. But you're right, it's tough. It's tough and it's hard when you're in this situation. So I guess the sort of impetus, if you like, or the best way to navigate it is to try and get through these negotiations and try and sort things out in as quick a timescale as you can. So Daniel, going back to that point then, when people are having to move out, how do they, and they've got to do all of this stuff for their divorce in terms of understanding how they're going to divide properties, that kind of stuff, how can they get their property valued?
To get your property valued, there are a couple of different ways. But the first thing to be mindful of is your local market, the wider market as well, but your local market will have the most bearing on your property price. the property market is a living, breathing beast. So it's very unlikely whatever you paid for your home whenever you bought it is going to be what it's worth today. So for instance, 2/3 of homeowners have seen their house price rise over the last 12 months, but that's tempering over the last 6 months we're seeing in the market. But it's totally different depending on what local area you're in. But the first thing you should do is try to get a decent estimate of your home's value today. You can actually do that on Zoopla. We've got an instant valuation tool that will give you a strong estimate of what your home could be worth in the market. But really, nothing beats the real deal of having an agent and come to your home, discuss your property, the local market, what changes you may have made to it, and to give you a valuation that way. And again, you can find the right estate agent, the right local estate agent for you via Zoopla.
Okay, brilliant. And normally we would say, wouldn't we, Shupali, to get more than one agent to come round and to get a few and then to take kind of an average. But that's a perfectly kind of good way of getting a sense of what your property is worth, right?
Absolutely. So going to one agent often won't satisfy both sides. So to speak to a couple of local agents, because often agents have slightly different experience and they'll take things like extensions into account, as well as, you know, whether they're close to a school or not. And then, yeah, taking an average of those three values so that you're able to be a little bit more realistic about what that value is and what can be achieved.
And I would just add, if I may, when it comes to choosing an agent, there's a lot of things to consider. A lot of people think it's about choosing the agent with the lowest commission, with the lowest fee. That might not always be the right route. There'll be agents that you get a feel will have a database of clients, potential buyers that might better suit your home. They might just display, a certain agent might display a better understanding for your type of property or have a good track record of selling similar types of homes to yours. So yeah, I'd back that, I'd echo that and speak to several agents and find out which feels like the best match for you.
Daniel, do you think that estate agents are alive and aware to the different way maybe they need to, I suppose, react, sell, behave, whatever, when people are actually selling their property due to a divorce? Do you think there's much understanding out there?
I think they're very much aware of that. Harking back to my point at the top of the pod, and think about what moves the market from aspiration to need, it's often talked about that death, debt, divorce are prime movers of the market. So I expect agents to be pretty tuned in to the nuances of selling a home owned by a couple in the process of divorce. Obviously, there's such a wide variety of agents. Some have different strengths, from boutique brands to kind of larger national corporations. So it might depend a bit more on your specific agent, but I think agents are pretty clued up for the different reasons people could be selling and what that means for them.
Because Shripali, it's quite an art, isn't it? The way you communicate with a couple when they're going through a divorce and making sure you've copied and involved everybody in the right decisions and all of the emailing. And sometimes it can feel with estate agents like they just want to do the job as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And actually, it takes a little bit of time to bring some people on a journey, doesn't it? Particularly if you're selling a house when clearly one partner does not want to move, does not want to sell, may feel the breakdown of the relationship isn't their doing and doesn't see why their life should be disrupted. It's very difficult then to get that person on board with the sales process, isn't it?
It's incredibly difficult, which is why it's so helpful to at least have more than one agent who's engaged, because like Daniel said, they're going to have different strengths and different weaknesses and be able to tap into different things in an effort to try to help that party that isn't willing to engage in the process. So yeah, it's really important that everybody gets on board to help the process move a little bit more swiftly.
Now, one of the things that's quite interesting is the way you document all of this and how you make, you know, splitting the proceeds of a sale the end of the matter, legally binding and all that kind of stuff. Daniel has said at the top of the podcast that, you know, how you own a property can dictate how the proceeds of a sale are divided. But when it comes to divorcing, can you just do that privately, Shripali? Does that count, or do you need other documents to demonstrate how all the proceeds can be split?
You can absolutely reach agreements privately, but the difficulty with that is that they're not legally binding. So there's that you don't have that clarity and that certainty and that sort of ability to enforce. And a lot of people misunderstand and think that divorce simply ends financial claims, and it doesn't. So you can go through the divorce process and not deal with the finances in a formalized way, which means that both of you can still make claims against one another. So the way that we encourage people to deal with their financials arrangements is by documenting everything. So transferring their legal agreements into a legal document called a consent order, and then lodging that with the court and getting that approved by a judge, and a judge being satisfied that that agreement is fair, and then essentially approving that agreement.
Right. So even if you've got your kind of ownership documented out in a deed of trust, as Daniel mentioned at the beginning, you still would need a consent order in order to show how you're dividing the property, whether that's the same or differently to that deed of trust. You'd still need a consent order to end future financial claims by either of you against the other in the future.
Correct. Right. Without that consent order, the couples are not going to have the security that their financial claims have been resolved by the court.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Daniel also mentioned like the timing of all of this. It seems like you could get the kind of house sold before you were through the divorce process, or you could have divided proceeds of sale and then retrospectively want to make that legal. Is that all possible, or is there a specific order you have to do things in?
So it is possible. There isn't a specific way. I mean, the usual way would be to reach an agreement within the process and to have that approved and then implemented. But there's nothing to stop people from implementing their agreement before it's approved by the court, and just bearing in mind that that needs to be subject to approval. And it might be that if their circumstances have changed very slightly, they need to make the court aware of that at the time at which they lodge their consent order.
And I mean, also, I guess there are other ways of doing this, aren't there? You've talked a little bit, Shripali, about the court's perspective and priority of looking after any children of a marriage. What happens if, as Daniel said earlier, there are just too many barriers to selling the property and moving out at a given time? Maybe you're stuck in a fixed rate mortgage, the redemption payments are too high, maybe it's just better to stay put. Are there different orders that you can have as part of your divorce that set those things out?
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of different ways of dealing with the property to take account of specific circumstances. And it's very usual that because of affordability, it's just not possible to sell the property at the same time as finalizing your divorce, because the children are young, the primary carer needs to be in the home looking after the children and doesn't have the ability and the affordability to move on. So there are various ways that you can deal with the property. There are property adjustment orders. There's an order called a mesher order, where you would defer the sale and you would deal with the proceeds in a certain way on a usual trigger point, which includes the youngest reaching a certain age, generally 17, or completing secondary education, or whatever other trigger points you want to put into place. So there are lots of ways of dealing with the property in order to accommodate specific individual needs and certainly affordability.
And Daniel, just going back to the survey that you spoke a little bit about before, out of all the things that you asked, what were you most surprised about? What shocked you the most in terms of people's responses?
I think there was a stat in there that 1 in 8 who remain living with their ex are forced to continue sharing a bedroom with them. That sounded like a really unpleasant situation to be forced to remain in. I thought the thinking or the results around, in our survey, I think we called it an escape fund or an emergency fund. So who has got money set aside in order to be able to get out there if they really need to, such as renting a home. And I thought it was interesting and quite worrying that there was such a skew towards women not having that escape fund, with the 47% of women that didn't have that. So I think they were probably the most surprising things that emerged from it for me.
And just in terms of looking at, you know, how people can navigate this space, it feels like it's complicated. We know it's a priority for people. Of course it is. If you're going to separate, whether you're married or not, you need to know where you're going to live. It's kind of like a fundamentalist at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, isn't it? Having basic shelter and making sure you've got somewhere to live. What would be your top tips, Daniel, if you're in a situation where you're going to separate or divorce, from your perspective and what you found in your data, what would you be urging people to do?
Well, as much as it's retrospective, I think any upfront conversations as you're purchasing a property together in the earlier stages of relationship about what you would do if you split up or divorce and have to sell, even though they are not romantic at all in nature, are actually really, really useful, and it could be something that you rely on later down the line. But if you are in a situation where you do own and you are splitting up, I think be informed, do as much research as you can, such as listening to podcasts like this, but also seeking legal and financial advice and to understand the options available to you, as we've spoken about. And then I think if you're in a position where you can make a plan together and think through the nitty-gritty of any additional costs associated with selling your home and moving. We also found that things like estate agents' fees were often not considered, or even the cost of putting furniture into storage, or removals costs. These do mount up, especially if one of you is paying for rent as well as your mortgage payments, and then you have some of these unforeseen costs. So I think being as prepared and taking advantage of all the research available to you is probably the best you can do in that situation.
Yeah, because there are some, you know, really good kind of basic formulas you can use, aren't there, in terms of just working out costs and things. Like you say, people often forget estate agent fees. There's sometimes legal fees, moving costs. And one of the common ones for us is if one of you is moving out and there isn't excess furniture to take, you've got to refurnish a new home as well. And that it's not always fair that the person who's moving out is bearing the full cost of that. There has to be some negotiation around how you're going to furnish a new property. So I think there are lots of costs that people need to think about when they're selling and buying properties. Obviously, stamp duty comes into it as well. And if you're in the situation where you might own two properties at once for a period of time, or your name might be on kind of two property title deeds at one time, then that becomes quite complicated. And you do need to get some advice on how to navigate that, don't you, in terms of excess stamp duty and those sorts of things. Shripali, what do you think then are the top tips around property and divorce? What would you be saying to people?
So just linking into to what you said, it's quite important also where there are multiple properties to get tax advice and to understand when you're looking at the bigger picture. Often people don't appreciate that if they've got more than one property and they have an arrangement which includes some sort of a property adjustment order or a mesh order, like I suggested earlier, that there may well be tax implications. So it's really important to get informed, but just generally to be informed and to understand that there are options. And in order to look at those options, to understand what resources are available, and also just to have a think about what that separation, that financial separation, is going to look like and how it's going to feel in 5 years' time at some point in the future, especially where there are children involved, sort of with an eye on preserving a relationship going forward and bearing that in mind.
Yeah. And I guess when there's a cost of living crisis and when everyone's backs are against the wall with increased rents and mortgage interest rates, you have to be more creative. And for me, the only way you can be creative properly is if you're on good terms with each other. So I think from my perspective, this is, as Daniel said earlier, if you can have those conversations early on, before there's a problem, it's always good to have a process written down or something written down where you've got some idea of how you'll go about tackling this. But just trying to get yourselves into that more amicable space so you can exercise your creative options is so much better than just doing this with your a gun against your head and trying to fight it through solicitors or whatever. So I think my top tip really would be that you've got to try and create a relationship where you can be creative in these tough times, because this is a really hard thing to navigate. And if you are, you know, forced to share a property for longer than you might want to, then trying to create some rules around how to stay amicable, particularly if you've got kids, is absolutely vital, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Listen, it's been fascinating talking to you both. Thank you very much for sharing your hints and tips about property and divorce. It's been really good to listen to you both. Daniel, where can people find out more about you and Zoopla?
Download the Zoopla app or head to zoopla.co.uk. On there, you'll find ways to get an estimate for what your home could be worth. You can contact estate agents, as we said, but you can also access our raft of guides and news, some of which cover macro market environment, but some of which offer guidance on exactly this kind of topic.
Brilliant. Thank you. And Tripali, where can people find out more about you?
So there's a link to Amicable's website on the show notes. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and TikTok as Amicable_world, and we're on Facebook and Twitter as Amicable Apps.
Brilliant. Thank you. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm @Kate_daily, and hear more about new podcast episodes by subscribing for updates and visiting thedivorcepodcast.com or on your favorite listening platform. Thank you both very much. It's been wonderful talking to you, and thank you everybody for listening.